Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. In the exhibition, Outliers and American Vanguard Art, more than 250 works explore three distinct periods in American history when mainstream and outlier artists intersected, ushering in new paradigms based on inclusion, integration, and assimilation. On view at the National Gallery of Art from January 28th through May 13th, 2018, the exhibition aligns work by such diverse artists as Charles Sheeler, Christina Romberg, and Matt Mullican, with both historic folk art and works by self-taught artists ranging from Horace Pippin to Janet Sobel and Joseph Joachim. It also examines a recent influx of radically expressive work made on the margins that redefined the boundaries of the mainstream art world and challenged the very categories of outsider and self-taught. Historicizing the shifting identity and role of this distinctly American version of modernism's other, the exhibition probes assumptions about creativity, artistic practice, and the role of the artist in contemporary culture. Lynn Cook introduces the exhibition in this lecture held on February 4th, 2018.
For this introductory talk today, I thought I would not give a formal academic lecture, but rather address the subject as the curator and look at some of the curatorial issues that have shaped the exhibition and that may prove, I hope, useful guidelines to you as you see the exhibition or re-see it. I began the subject in researching the subject in 2012 as Andrew W. Mellon Professor at the Center for Advanced Studies in the Visual Arts here, CASVA, at the National Gallery. And I was broadly thinking about where are the boundaries between what is shown in museums of modern and contemporary art and what is considered inappropriate or irrelevant or not part of the proper area of study. I wouldn't have embarked upon it if I hadn't had a two-year fellowship, because I knew it would take me into territory that I was wholly unfamiliar with, and indeed it did. And having a two-year fellowship also gave me time to look for the parameters of the project. As I said, I didn't know the material beforehand, but from the beginning, I anticipated realizing it in some way in the form of an exhibition rather than as a book. And that was a very decisive decision in that it immediately set up certain possibilities and perhaps closed down others. But it was prophetic in ways that I hadn't realized at the time, in that the whole question of how art made on the margins has been brought into the realm of modern and contemporary art. This has been done, I would argue, through one of two means. One, and perhaps the most important, has been exhibitions that have been made in museums of modern and contemporary art. Because if you think of something that doesn't qualify as fine art, for it to be discussed or brought into dialogue with this material, then it has to find a public forum. And it was museums of modern art and curators and directors there that saw this work, brought it into the collection, brought it into the exhibition program, classified it, identified it, validated it, and showed it, which allowed people to see it, critics to debate it, and historians ultimately to discuss it. So, exceptionally, museums have been, through these exhibition and acquisitions programs, have been decisive arbiters in this history. And the second way this material enters into the public arena, but connected, is through the advocacy of mainstream artists. By mainstream artists, I'm really talking about different avant-gardes across the 20th century. I'm talking, therefore, about artists usually with formal academic training and knowledge of the histories and traditions of modern art. And it's these two credentials, the academic training in academies or art schools and colleges, and it's an awareness of what the history of modern art is and its discourses, which in conventional parlance, separate these artists, these vanguards, from artists on the periphery who by definition are uncredentialed, who don't have the benefit for a variety of reasons of this training, nor of an understanding of the discourse of the art world. As I began to delve into the history, it quickly became evident that the narrative of intersection between American vanguards and artists on the fringes, and these could be artists known under a variety of rubrics like folk, visionary, isolate, modern primitive, outsider, and so forth. These are all terms that have been used for artists of who make work under these terms, but terms that are historically specific and can mean different things at different times, and I'll come back to that in a minute. But it became clear, as I started to say, that in the US, this is a different history from, say, Latin America or Europe. And for example, in Europe, with the exception of Henri Rousseau, who was thought of as a naive when he was acclaimed by artists like Picasso and André Breton, Delaunay, and others in the early 20th century, most of the work that comes under this heading of self-taught work in Europe has been what was known in the 20s and 30s as psychotic art, or art of the insane. That is, it was produced by people with mental and developmental disabilities who were usually in institutions. With very few exceptions, this is not the history in the US. Here, the disenfranchised have tended to be disenfranchised for other reasons, largely reasons of class, race, ethnicity, gender, and sometimes age. So, as I said, the histories revealed themselves quickly to be different, and I decided to focus on an American narrative, partly because it's less well known, and partly because it seemed to have opportunities for thinking through these questions that were very relevant to those of us who work in museums today. Questions around issues of diversity and inclusion. When you go to the exhibition, you'll see that it starts with in the lobby, and it moves around in a circular enfilade of galleries. But there is also, as you may have noticed as you came into this auditorium, in the lobby here, a suite of prints by Kara Walker and a painting by Sam Doyle. And these are also part of this exhibition, though not in the galleries. And they're positioned there because I think that they speak to the making of cultural narratives. After all, in an auditorium this and like this, there will be film programs, there will be a symposium, there will be lectures. And in this way, histories of this material will be contested, unfolded, and perhaps remade in certain respects. And these two works both bear upon the making of history, who actually is authorized to construct histories, what we regard as official histories. The Kara Walker is a suite of prints that she made in 2005 based on Harper's Illustrated History of the Civil War, a book produced in the 1870s, and she's taken illustrations from that official narrative and intervened in a number of ways, often by placing black silhouettes of figures over the top of the original engravings, which have been blown up to large scale. And in so doing, she's talking about those who are excluded from the official narratives, those who have other views on those battles, those historical episodes, those voices who that were not written into the narrative in order to make us think about how history is written, by whom and for whom. And the Sam Doyle is quite different but relevant, I think, to put with the Walker. Sam Doyle was a man who lived on St. Helena Island in the Sea Islands off the Carolinas coast, and who became his community's chronicler. He painted mostly on roofing tin. The example here is on a window shade. And he painted mostly portraits of figures in his communities and key figures, such as the first embalmer in his community, the first undertaker, the first doctor, and others. And in this way, he provided a kind of living history of those who made up his immediate collective environment. But he occasionally also painted other subjects of particular historic figures and others of significance to the community. And in local law, it seems that it was believed that Lincoln stopped in Frogmore on the coast on his march south during the Civil War in order to free slaves. Whether or not this is historically accurate is less important, I think, than the way local law and local and histories based in collective memory and community are established. And so in putting them together, you can see different ways in which the narratives of the American past have been addressed or could need to be readdressed in Walker's terms. You also pass, as you go into the galleries proper, between two figures, the school teacher by William Edmondson and a second carving by Lonnie Holly, From the Beginning to the End, to the Beginning. Both of these are direct carving. One was made in 1935 by Edmondson, who was a man whose job was as a janitor in Women's Hospital in Nashville, but who also worked as a tombstone carver. Through a series of events, his work was brought to the attention of Alfred Barr, who was the founding director of the Museum of Modern Art. And Barr, by 1935, was beginning to move very strongly in the campaign to include what he saw as modern primitives in the narratives of modern art that were being written by that institution through its exhibition programs, its acquisitions in its collections, and through the discourse it generated. And Barr decided that there should be a solo exhibition of Edmondson's work. This took place in 1937. It was the first time work by an African-American artist had been shown at the Museum of Modern Art, which had been founded in 1929, but already by the mid-30s had claimed the ground as the most influential and significant museum of modern art in the country. And it not only was it the first time that work by an African-American was shown in those galleries, it was the first time that an exhibition had been given to a self-taught artist. And on the basis of that, Edmondson, who was identified as a modern primitive, this was a term that was current then, it's not a term we'd use now, he gained wider patronage from a white audience in Nashville. He expanded the repertoire of subjects in his oeuvre. He began to self-identify as an artist. And he developed in a different way from what is probable had his work not been brought into this intersection of with the modern art world. And he gained agency in, to a degree, in determining his, if not his career, at least his production and conception of his work. And Lonnie Holly is placed, one example of his work's placed nearby. Lonnie Holly is the youngest of the self-taught artists in the exhibition. He's in his 60s, he's working very actively, he has a music career as well as a performer, and will perform here on April the 8th. But he's someone who is representative, I think, in one respect of a self-taught artist working today, in that he disavows the term. His work was first brought into the circuits of mainstream museums as someone who had no training and who turned to carving with casting stone like this following a family tragedy when his nieces were killed in a house fire, and he spontaneously carved a kind of memorial tombstones for them. But as I said, Holly now, his work circulates in the art world, and he picks and chooses when he will have his work positioned and framed as folk or self-taught, but for the most part, he chooses not to. So these are like bookends of the show, in a sense. And then as you come down the steps, you enter the lobby proper to the galleries, and you immediately, I think, understand that you're looking at very contemporary work. And I positioned these the works by these four artists there as both the starting point and the ending point to reinforce the idea that the questions that come up in the intersection of the world of self-taught artists, the work of self-taught artists with the mainstream, are questions of this moment. Even though, as I'll explain in a minute, there's a strong historical basis to the exhibition, it's the urgency of these questions as they face us now, of inclusion and diversity, that makes looking to the past relevant, I would argue. And what you see here is work by four artists. Two of them had art school training and have careers from that moment with galleries and museum representation. Two of them did not. But it's impossible, I think, to tell just looking at their work which are which. And that's very much the point. Two were trained at Yale, two did not. One of the two that did not had no knowledge of art world, the art world's infrastructure, what going to an art school would be like, so forth. But all of them, all are women, all work with fiber, yarn, and textiles. All of them are engaged, I would argue, with questions proper to sculpture and to painting in different ways. All of them, their work hovers somewhere between craft and fine art. It doesn't identify strictly as painting, for sure, and arguably might be sculpture, but if it's sculpture, then it's sculpture that uses processes and materials that are gendered female and that mostly would be located with references and associations to the domestic and to hand production, to a lesser realm of art activity than painting and sculpture. But I think in the dialogue around them, these questions as to how to think about them in relation to issues in painting and sculpture start to dominate over questions of biography and training and history, and to render those questions less important and less significant. So, as I said, there is a strong historical component to this exhibition, and I think you could summarize this succinctly in William Faulkner's very well-known axiom, the past is not dead, it's not even past. It's the way that history is a lens illuminating the present that I am interested in thinking through. So the exhibition begins during the First World War, immediately as war breaks out or seems imminent in Europe, many American vanguard artists who'd been living and working in Berlin or Paris come back, and artists start to no longer look to European avant-gardes, but to think about patrimony, to think about what an American art might be, just as the 20s moves forward, the question of American identity gains traction with immigration laws in 1924 that restrict immigration in ways that continue really up through the 60s, and through nativist cultural arguments that look for the roots of a specifically American indigenous art form. And they turn above all to historic folk art, which up until that moment had not been considered of any significance whatsoever, and start to collect it, both the kind of limmer paintings, like the one you see on the left, and they also collect whirligigs, signs, children's toys, artifacts, religious artifacts, and so forth, all of which they admire for several reasons, mostly to do with craftsmanship, for the abbreviated formal qualities, the economy of form, and the kind of succinctness, the flatness, the way in which outlines and contours are used to define form rather than elaborate modeling techniques and the like. And it's less a case of influence and more a case of affinity. They recognize in this aspects and qualities in their own work and embrace it. Some of them for strictly aesthetic reasons and others because they're increasingly engaged with the question of what an American art might be. So these are examples of the kind of artifacts they looked at. And by the mid-20s, the Whitney Studio Club, which is the forerunner of the Whitney Museum of American Art, had asked one of this group of avant-garde artists to make an exhibition that was of folk art objects that he and his peers and friends had collected. And this is really the first example of a significant exhibition in the public arena that marks a bench point for when this work comes into close attention of the art world. At the same time, others like Elie Nadelman had become so enamored of this work that he was buying it in vast quantities and set up the first museum of folk and peasant art in Riverdale in the Bronx in the country and collected records, say, 40,000, 60,000 objects of this kind, an extraordinary number. At a certain point, he lost his money during the Depression, and a significant part of his holdings was bought by the New York City Historical Society, where you can still see examples in their collection. But Nadelman's own work spoke to this too, as he changed from a kind of classicizing carving in marble to works in cherry wood, like the one on the left, which clearly look to folk art carvings and artifacts for reference. And in the works that you see on the right, these very small plaster pieces, which were never shown, they were made in molds, and his plan was that he would make multiples in molds, but then paint them individually and sell them to a mass market, not a high-end fine art market, and so reach a very wider, a much wider audience, a demographic. That was completely different from the inner circles of the art world. And his thinking was clearly inspired by the role of chalkware in the late 19th century, which was sold in by traveling salesmen to people in small villages, towns, and the like. And so these are examples that he actually had. And also Charles Sheeler, who's part of this group, who is the first person to look at Shaker artifacts seriously from an aesthetic perspective, from within the vanguard art world. And he collected them. You see a painting of his domestic interior. There's a Shaker box on the table. It's a Shaker refectory table. There are rag rugs, there are quilts and the like. And this is the kind of Shaker box. What you're seeing here is not an, I didn't bring actual artifacts in, with the exception of the paintings. You see a watercolor drawing, a watercolor representation, and this is one of eight from an archive of 18,000 watercolor renderings of American applied arts, decorative art, arts, furniture, signage, a whole wealth of material. And this was started in 1935 as part of the New Deal programs, which were devised under Roosevelt to provide jobs for artists in one section and for commercial artists and illustrators in another. And the plan was to find good examples of these works in every state across the country under strict supervision for quality control, and even the terms like the angle at which an object was represented, how finely the textile was rendered. All of this was carefully calibrated because the plan was that in the end, this huge archive would not only have given jobs, it would have been, parts of it would have made exhibitions which toured the country, would have a pedagogical role, and it would also serve as a repository from which new design would be generated in the future. What's also interesting is that when the plan was being hatched in 1935, it was by a man called Holger Cahill, who'd been one of the first to make exhibitions in museums of this material. When he did that in 1930 and 31, he showed these works under the rubric of painting and sculpture, and clearly fine art categories, but not really suitable to this. By 1935, it was accepted that these were decorative and applied art objects, and that as folk art of this kind, it was still worthy of representation and presentation in modern art museums. So you see an interesting shift in that. And also, I think it's interesting to know that as the program was being put in place, there was a debate whether the object should be represented photographically or through watercolors. And after consulting archaeologists, and I think Egyptologists in particular, they decided upon watercolor because watercolor was said to provide more information than photographs would have. Very interesting. And very important, I think, in terms of thinking about art making at this moment. And then I'll show you an example of a likely source in the case of Palmer Hayden, who is an African-American artist working in the 30s who'd come back from Paris, whose play on the kind of failure to realize the promises that were offered to African-Americans fighting in the forces in the First World War, failure to realize those issues was very relevant in 1939 as campaigns to recruit again from the African-American world, again with promises that would not necessarily be fulfilled immediately. And the use of a carousel horse plays into this. But just as the white avant-garde was looking at folk and vernacular traditions, so African-American artists were advised and encouraged to do so by critics and cultural historians. And within that history, music, of course, is of immense importance. The spirituals and gospels were recognized as amongst the greatest contributions to American culture at that time. And a number of African-American artists like Malvin Gray Johnson take a spiritual as the starting point for a painting. This is one of a series of 9 paintings he made. There's another one in the exhibition. And then also in this gallery, there's another dynamic crossing it that runs from Marsden Hartley through back through objects represented in the index onto contemporary folk artists. And this concerns the newfound interest, again, just after the end of the war, in the Southwest, in the cultures of Pueblo Indians and what was called Hispano art, that is the Spanish Catholic tradition that had come up through Mexico of making of religious artifacts, sculpture and paintings like the one represented here that are a kind of vernacular offshoot of the fine art traditions that had been brought from Spain to the New World. And Hartley, Marsden Hartley, who had been painting in Europe, in Paris and Berlin, comes back as war breaks out, first starts looking at work from the Northeast, like the folk art I was just showing you, and then goes to Taos and Santa Fe in, as a guest of Mabel Dodge Lewin, and becomes enormously interested in this material, and you see it represented in one of a number of paintings he makes at this time. And also within this narrative of New Deal activities, as I said, it was not just commercial artists and illustrators who were given jobs. Fine artists were also on the rolls, and people who had never been able to paint full-time were able to. This includes Willem de Kooning and Achille Gorky, but it also includes people like Patrocinio Barella, who was an itinerant workman who lived in New Mexico, and who had come to the attention of the head of the local agency, the WPA there, who was impressed by his abilities to repair some of these historic sculptures and put him on the rolls. And Barella quickly revealed a great talent and a highly individual approach to this. And so compared with the work you just saw before, this manner, this historic work, you can see how quickly he's taken it in a very independent manner. And also there, as it were, working the tradition from within is José Dolores López. So their work is shown in the same gallery between the work represented in the index and Hartley, and you can, in a sense, it's a spatializing of an argument. That's what an exhibition can do. It can put various components which make up arguments that are being played out, partly in terms of visual references across the space of the gallery, and partly through the backstory of the genesis of the works and their reception. But what it's interesting, too, just to think about how this comes into confluence, to know that there was an exhibition in 1936, again at the Museum of Modern Art, in which work from the WPA, different branches across the states, was shown, and it included the index examples, and it included Barella, and Barella was called out by Time magazine's reviewer as Artist of the Year. It's quite something. So, in a sense, what you see is a move from an interest from vanguard artists in a historic tradition to the recognition of a living maker within a folk art tradition as a substantial artist on a par with vanguard artists whose work would be shown elsewhere in the museum. Which brings me to Gallery 2 and to a shift of focus. This is centered around the activities of Alfred Barr, whom I mentioned before, who had this campaign, basically, over 10 years to bring work, beginning with that of Henri Rousseau, the greatest exponent of this in Barr's opinion and really in the art world at the time, to bring this legacy up into the present, into the museum, and to write it into the history of art. And so there was a major exhibition in 1938 in which he did this, and the second gallery includes work by the artists in that exhibition. And the work that was shown then, some of it was purchased for the museum, and in 1941, when the museum opened its new building, when it had its first purpose-built galleries, and for the first time, galleries that were devoted to the collection. Previously, the collection examples had been put up intermittently. Now there's the opportunity to lay out the history of modern art through these permanent collection galleries. The very first gallery in this enfilade was devoted to modern primitives. In other words, this was the starting point, as the museum saw it, for the history they would trace subsequently through Cézanne, the four post-impressionist cubism, and on. So this gallery brings to light these works for reconsideration. Most of them, with the exception of Rousseau, which comes from, these examples come from the National Gallery, most of them actually come from the Museum of Modern Art, or most of them have been in storage since 1938, I think, with a few exceptions. And this is the only gallery where you see European work, the only gallery that has non-American work, because it was Barr's conviction that self-taught work of significance and quality was being made in the modern world. Therefore, it was being made in Europe, and it was made in North America, and it was very similar. It was not an American phenomenon, and so he's in directly contradicts the nativist arguments of the 20s and the arguments that the previous gallery had outlined. And so I've brought the European examples to put them in dialogue with American examples, as he did, to make the point that this was a very different position and to suggest that maybe there are other ways of reading them. So what you'll see here is a range of work from Edward Hicks, who today is a much beloved artist, who was not at all known in the 1930s. And so Hicks's work is found again and brought into the museum. And John Kane, Barr regarded this self-portrait as the finest portrait made in modern era by any American, trained or untrained. So again, a very big claim, and from our perspective, perhaps a surprising claim, when you think who else was painting portraits in the US in the 1930s. There was visionary painting, Patrick Sullivan, totally unknown until that moment, someone who only made probably 20 paintings in his life, and Seraphine Louis, who was well known in Paris by the 30s as an artist with an extraordinary vision. Mostly she's painting the tree of life, sometimes she's painting flowers and bowls of vegetation in this kind of very fecund, celebratory way. And a French artist, two French artists in fact, Camille Bombois, who was well known in the US already by 1938, Dominique Perrineau, who's painting a subject from history of the Franco-German War, in which the ferryman, who's a Frenchman, in an act of loyalty agrees to ferry the German troops across the Moselle. Halfway across, he cuts the rope and they all perish. The episode had then spawned a popular song of the time. So again, it's the ways in which subjects like this run through vernacular traditions that is important. And the third gallery looks at the moment of the early 40s, where Barr's campaign, you might say, has become so successful that some of the self-taught artists are taken up by contemporary galleries, they are having exhibitions across the country, their work is being seen on a level playing field, and the museum itself is doing other shows that present self-taught work without distinction or apology. This is a momentous moment as I see it. And you can see here's Hartley in another vein in the late 30s, memorializing a drowned Abelard, a friend of his, a seaman who died tragically, and he chooses this archaizing manner. It's not a naturalistic painting, it's one that brings gravitas and dignity and a kind of hieratic solemnity to the figure. The lost Felice is the sister, and it was Hartley's plan to establish a chapel, a memorial chapel for Abelard and his brother. But the point here is to look at what we would call primitivizing in the trained artist, and another example would be William H. Johnson, who'd spent 20 years in Europe before the outbreak of the Second World War, and who on coming back discarded a manner that was close to Soutine and Cézanne in favor of a deliberate primitivizing manner and took up subjects important to the African American community, which he was part, John Brown, the abolitionist on the left, and again, this famous gospel. And another tribute to John Brown, who was very, very significant figure at that time, by Horace Pippin, and an artist who was really the best known black artist of his day. Work that's now in the National Gallery's collection. Pippin had no training, but again, after support from white critics and some patronage and gallery representation, he began to paint across the full spectrum of the academic genre, portraits, genre scenes, historical subjects, and the like. And in the galleries, he's placed opposite Hartley, whose repertoire is very comparable. Little known is the fact that Bill Traylor, who's perhaps today seen as one of the finest draftsmen in 20th century American art, his work was actually known at the time, albeit briefly. Traylor had been born a slave in Alabama, and right at the end of his life, when he was 80, he moved to Montgomery and was very poor, but spent his days on the streets making drawings. Drawings like these on found material, like the cardboard used to stiffen shirts, other kinds of papers. And his work was noticed by a young white artist who was just immensely struck by it, who provided him with more art materials, particularly poster paint, and encouraged him, and then kept the drawings for safety. And Charles Shannon, this young artist, sent some drawings to Barr because he thought they were important and would be of interest to Barr, as they were. And he hoped, obviously, that they would be included in the museum's collection. Barr, for reasons that are not known, initially proposed buying them for his own collection, as did other of his colleagues. And through misunderstanding, the deal fell through. Shannon withdrew the drawings, and they were seen briefly at Fieldston School, 42, and then they were not seen for the next 30 years. There's absolutely a sense that there was not interest for them. So while the story of Pippin leads, say, to a strong reputation, to opportunity, to agency, there are many stories like Traylor or Barella, which end when circumstances don't allow the work to be cemented into the museum's realm, I suppose. And I'll talk briefly about this work because it's used on the catalog cover, it's used on the banner as you come into the museum and on much of the press. And I chose it very deliberately because I wanted a work that would not be instantly recognizable, but I wanted a work that would have subject matter that spoke to the exhibition and that would also create a sort of sense of doubt or uncertainty about it, what exactly this work was doing. It's by Jacob Lawrence, who's a very well-known African-American artist. It's in a style that Lawrence is not really known for. The works like those in the Great Migration series, that's partly here at the Phillips Collection, partly at the Museum of Modern Art, I'm sure is familiar to many of you. Lawrence's work there are very few works that look like this. It's painted in 1943. It's a year, he's still very young, and he's moving in circles in Harlem. A coterie of African-American artists around Studio 306, which includes such figures as Charles White and Henry Bannon, whose sculpture of John Brown's is seen also in the exhibition. And at this point, Lawrence is recognized as a kind of prodigy, this young artist with a great gift, facility, this kind of childlike, he's not childish, but childlike manner. And the question he's facing is whether he should get more, he should get academic training. And White says he should, and Bannon says he shouldn't. And the question is about preserving his vision, whether his vision is so special that if he has more training, he'll actually lose it as he becomes more familiar with academic techniques and conventions and the like. And so he's in a liminal state. It's the same year that the first history of African-American art is written by James Porter, who's here in DC teaching at Howard. And in Porter's book, he classifies Lawrence, whose work he knows well, as self-taught. He says he's a virtuoso naïf. So he puts him with Edmondson and with Pippin, and not with figures like White or himself for that matter. So the liminal status is there, and then the subject matter, Lawrence is drawing children drawing on the street. And of the many categories that this term modern primitive covered in this era, it included self-taught adult naive artists, it included tribal work, it included the art of the insane, but it also included children's drawings. So Lawrence is drawing like the children. He's, if you like, sort of ventriloquizing them. And the children are, these two girls, are drawing their world. And their world in 1943 is a world at war. It's a world in which there's combat, this world in which issues of patriotism come to the fore. And one seems to be finishing a figure of a young girl, maybe herself, a self-portrait. The other seems to be finishing off a drawing of an apartment block, perhaps where she lived. And what I think the drawing shows is that the children, though young, have a very sophisticated understanding of their context. This is not heedless play, you might say. They're very aware of their world. And though they draw age appropriately, their consciousness, their sophistication is manifest. And I think this speaks exactly to the issues that Lawrence was thinking about and is wonderfully playful in so doing. So this work, and because it has the virtue of not being instantly recognizable and not much seen, it hasn't been exhibited for over 20 years, I think, this work became a very important touchstone for thinking through the issues of the exhibition. I realize I don't have a great deal more time. I've spent a lot of it on this first section because I think that the main debates that get set up here are the debates that then come through in the other two parts of the exhibition. And because, as I've been saying, I think something very exceptional goes on in these years, really through both the advocacy of artists like Sheila and Kuniyoshi and Nadelman for their self-taught peers, but also because the Museum of Modern Art takes this extraordinary position that the work of marginals can be shown on a level playing field without, as I said, apology or distinction amongst the work of some of the most acclaimed cutting-edge artists of the time. And this happens, and then by the end of the war, the whole situation turns. Barr is fired from his position as director for really in part over the presentation of this artist, Maurice Hirschfeld, in the solo show. It's kind of the last straw. Critics just really, or the conservative critics absolutely hate it. They think the museum should not be showing work of a self-taught maverick. It should be showing leading, well-trained American artists. The American Academy hates it. They feel that it's absurd to privilege these artists over members of their own rank and file. And there are other reasons given for Barr's demotion. But so that really stops the dynamic at the Museum of Modern Art. In addition, many of the figures whose work I've shown you die around these years. Pippin dies, Hartley dies, and so forth. So they are not visible any longer in the terms they had been. And of course, with the rise of abstract expressionism, which comes really through the mid-40s and on, the whole set of questions around what is important in contemporary art shifts. Shifts to abstraction, it shifts to an international remit, and this work seems irrelevant, lost from a time past. And so it really goes underground. The next time it comes to the fore is in the late 60s through the long 70s, that long decade, in the wake of the civil rights, feminist, gay, black arts movements, and so forth. And it comes back in very different terms. And I'll move forward quickly. When it does so, it's really no longer in New York. It's in the regions. And the demographic of the makers is usually quite different. They're no longer urbanites. They're no longer artists who are ready with encouragement to embrace the role of an artist and move into the circuits of museum and gallery presentation. They are people who, in large part, are making work for their own pleasure, or to serve a vision, or because they have a religious mission, and the work is part of that evangelical activity. And so in this second section, again at a time of great social, cultural, and political upheavals, through, as I said, from the late 60s through the 70s, find activity in very different parts of the country, above all around Chicago, with a group of painters who are graduates from the School of the Art Institute, who embrace the work of Joseph Joachim first, who is an African-American man in almost his 80s when he takes up drawings. He's living on the south side of Chicago. He puts them in his storefront apartment window. They're seen by someone who's connected to someone in the art world, and quickly Jim Nutt and his circle of friends go to visit Joachim, buy his work, bring Joachim's work into their own exhibitions, and so it goes forward. So too with the work of Martin Ramirez, who had come to the US in the 20s looking for work from northern Mexico, who has a breakdown, who's institutionalized, and makes work in DeWitt State Asylum over a 30-year period. And if you look at the work of Gladys Nilsson, Christina Ramberg, Nutt, Roger Brown, you can see from time to time there are stylistic formal affinities. But for these artists, above all, the self-taught peers served as mentors. They served as an example of what an independent career, a self-driven career would be, that didn't look to New York for validation, that wasn't caught up in contemporary trends. So there were seven or eight artists whose work they collected very strongly. And really, as you see here, the one on the left is owned by Jim Nutt, Gladys Nilsson, the one on the right by Matt Mulliken, another artist in the show. And I've tended to privilege work in artist collections because, again, it speaks to this direct act of promotion and acclaim. And then there's a section that looks at environmental installations, work made in different parts of the country by an individual over often decades, working in a quite solitary fashion. And works, places like this came to the fore in this same period. This is Jesse Fulton's property, Jesse Howard's property in Fulton, Missouri, a work by Jesse Howard. And I put it with Roger Brown's work. Brown had a very big collection of this material. And then in the South, similarly, for the first time it was recognized that a huge amount of highly significant art had been created over the past half century by African Americans, mostly but not exclusively, living in small rural communities with no awareness of or interest in the art world proper, and whose work tended increasingly not to be painting and sculpture or to be modifications of that. So with the Reverend Howard Finster, you see it involves painting, but then these stencils of aluminum which have been nailed onto the backboard and a kind of frame made with a burnishing instrument in an idiom that's often known as tramp art. And the Whittler, Appalachian Whittler, Edgar Tolson, Sister Gertrude Morgan, who had a vision, Elijah Pierce, who also was an itinerant preacher before he moved to Columbus. And you see again and again the importance of religious subject matter, not seen as part of, in a conventional sense, usually not seen as subject matter of interest in the modernist canon. Steve Ashby was working in Virginia. James Dunford Ford Thomas was a Delta blues musician who also made these unfired portraits of friends, community, historic figures, and deeply disturbing skulls. Sometimes the top of the head was scooped out so they could serve as ashtrays. Some of them have actual teeth, some of them have dentures, some of them have little stones. And Whirligigs, an old form for folk art by David Butler. And you see a great example of how these works would often be placed in an environment. This is David Butler's yard in Louisiana. This is Sam Doyle, I spoke of earlier, with Lincoln in Frogmore. And you see that Doyle put the paintings out in his yard to be sold to people who came by. And if he sold, say, his Lincoln in Frogmore, he would make another version. So there was constantly the set of sense of community and the historic figures and religious and subjects as well. And what isn't often so connected with this Southern work is work that was made in California, particularly in Los Angeles, around the Watts Towers in the aftermath of the mid-60s Watts Rebellion. And these, the five artists in this gallery, nearly all of them taught at the Watts Art Center, which is located right at the foot of the Watts Towers, or lived and worked there. They knew each other and they shared an interest in Southern vernacular traditions and in their African heritage. And you see it coming through in a variety of ways with quasi-ritualistic sculpture in the case of Purifoy on the left, and a work that contests oppressive racial stereotyping in the Betty Saar on the right. And some examples from Northern California, white artist Bruce Connor, whose crucifix using in part clay and pantyhose is of a really dark image that clearly speaks to lynching as well as to the crucifix. And opposite on the other side of the room, Senga Ngudi working around living and working around Watts, with a work that's more ritualistic but speaks to African traditions, ritual, performance, and other spiritualism. The last part of the exhibition looks to the present and to the era beginning in the 90s when this work started to come back into play for modern and contemporary art institutions, and it did so in different senses, but what I've tried to do here is pick three different subjects in order to question how one might go about integrating it again whether to adopt the terms of a level playing field and put it all in together, or whether there should be some more defining contexts and situations. So one of them is abstraction craft and vernacular traditions, and it connects very directly to the work you find in the lobby that I started where the exhibition concludes. And in this gallery, you see work beginning in the 1970s in New York by young artists who believe in abstraction but feel that the abstraction of the day has become moribund, that the work of Frank Stella and Gene Davis and the kind of leading figures of the time had brought abstraction to a cul-de-sac. And in looking for a way to free it up or to make it relevant or to widen its remit, they turned to textiles and in particular to quilting traditions. And Alan Shields, who grew up in Kansas on a farm, learned to sew as part of the many things he learned to do as a farm boy, and starts making paintings about the support of a painting, the grid structure, and then decorates them with beads and ornament. And Al Loving, his contemporary, who's African-American, starts cutting up his paintings, tie-dyeing them, and restitching them in ways that speak to the memories of quilts that were made in his family. And two more examples. On the right, you see a work by Annie Mae Young, who is one of the very renowned G's Bend quilters. And the argument that G's Bend has been the site where the most radical rethinking of quilt traditions has taken place in recent years is a very strong one. And the women working in this isolated rural community clearly valued highly personal expression that undermined standard quilting patterns and traditions. And this became very much a practice after their work had been shown and bought, or the work of their mothers and the generation before them, in the late 60s, where it was sold through Bloomingdale's and other outlets on the East, which gave a sense that quilt making had offered them other opportunities than strictly functional ones, the necessity of making coverlets for beds, and also gave them a sense, I think, that personal expression was of importance. And over the next 40 or so years, through the work of Annie Mae Young and Mary Lee Bendoff in particular, you see these remarkable textiles that speak directly to painting but are not surrogate paintings in any sense. And finally, work by Rosie Lee Tonkins, whose very large textile is in the lobby. She is a woman who lived in Oakland, who learned, as many young black girls do from the South, to quilt while a child, and who took it up in midlife not to make functional quilts, but to make textiles, it seems. Very little is known about her. When, through a series of circumstances, her work was brought into contemporary art circuits, including the Whitney Biennial in 2006, the show at the Berkeley Art Museum, she adopted a pseudonym. This is not her name, because she wanted to preserve her privacy. It wasn't that she didn't value having her work in a fine art context, but she didn't want to. She wanted to take that world on her own terms. And as a consequence, we know very little about her. But we know for sure that these were not made as quilts, certainly not as functional objects, but as artworks. And I think it's partly that you see in terms of the extraordinary way in which she uses materials or she composes that go way off the kind of standard grids and patterns of quilting, that allows her work very, very easily to enter into dialogue with Jessica Stockholder, Nancy Shaver, and Judith Scott, the other three artists whose work is in the lobby. Well, with that, I'll stop and thank you for coming.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.